continued to act as a sanctuary, and some of the more recent arrivals were also on the run. The only way anyone could find out about the place was from people such as Paul Beale, who had lived here for a while, then returned to the world outside, and they were very cautious about sharing the secret. There had never been a cop here. "How come I never heard of the place?" the cop said. "I've been a deputy here 10 years. "It's pretty small," Priest said. "You the owner?" "No, just a worker." "So what do you do here, make wine?" "Oh boy, an intellectual giant." "Yeah, that about sums it up." The cop did not pick up the irony. Priest went on. "What brings you to these parts so early in the morning? We haven't had a crime here since Charlie got drunk and voted for Jimmy Carter." He grinned. There was no Charlie. He was trying to make the kind of joke a cop might like. But this one remained straight-faced. "I'm looking for the parents of a young girl who gives her name as Flower." A terrible fear possessed Priest, and he suddenly felt as cold as the grave. "Oh, my God, what's happened?" "She's under arrest." "Is she okay?" "She's not injured in any way, if that's what you mean." "Thank God, I thought you were going to say she'd been in an accident." Priest's brain began to recover from the shock. "How can she be in jail? I thought she was here asleep in her bed." "Obviously not. How are you connected with her?" "I'm her father." "Then you'll need to come to Silver City." "Silver City? How long has she been there?" "Just overnight. We didn't want to keep her that long, but for a while she refused to tell us her address. She broke down an hour or so ago." Priest's heart lurched to think of his little girl in custody, trying to keep the secret of the commune until she broke down. Tears came to his eyes. The cop went on, "Even so, you were god-awful hard to find. In the end, I got directions from a bunch of damn gun-toting freaks about 5 miles down the valley from here." Priest nodded. "Los Alamos." "Yeah, had a damn big sign up saying, 'We do not recognize the jurisdiction of the United States government.' Assholes." "I know them," Priest said. They were right-wing vigilantes who had taken over a big old farmhouse in a lonely spot and now guarded it with high-powered firearms and dreamed of fighting off a Chinese invasion. Unfortunately, they were the commune's nearest neighbors. "Why is Flower in custody? Did she do something wrong?" "That is the usual reason," the cop said sarcastically. "What did she do?" "She was caught stealing from a store." "From a store? Why would a kid who had access to a free shop want to do that?" "What did she steal?" "A large-size color photograph of Leonardo DiCaprio." Priest wanted to punch the cop in the face, but that would not have helped Flower, so instead he thanked the man for coming here and promised that he and Flower's mother would appear at the sheriff's office in Silver City within an hour to pick up their daughter. Satisfied, the cop drove away. Priest went to Star's cabin. It doubled as the commune's clinic. Star had no medical training, but she had picked up a great deal of knowledge from her physician father and nurse mother. As a girl, she had got used to medical emergencies and had even assisted at births. Her room was full of boxes of bandages, jars of ointment, aspirins, cough medicines, and contraceptives. When Priest woke her and told her the bad news, she became hysterical. She hated the police almost as much as he did. In the 60s, she had been beaten by cops with nightsticks on demonstrations, sold bad dope by undercover narcs, and on one occasion raped by detectives in a precinct house. She jumped out of bed, screaming, and started hitting him. He held her wrists and tried to calm her down. "We have to go there now and get her out," Star yelled. "Right," he said. "Just get dressed first, okay?" She stopped struggling.
"Okay."
While she was pulling on her jeans, he said, "You were busted at 13, you told me." "Yeah, and a dirty old sergeant with a cigarette hanging from the corner of his mouth put his hands on my tits and said I was going to grow up into a beautiful lady." "It won't help Flower if you go in there mad and get yourself arrested, too," he pointed out. She got control of herself.
"You're right, Priest. For her sake, we have to ingratiate ourselves with those motherfuckers."
She combed her hair and glanced in a small mirror.
"All right, I'm ready to eat shit." priest had always believed it was best to be conventionally dressed when dealing with the police. He woke Dale and got from him the old dark blue suit. It was communal property now, and Dale had worn it most recently to go to court when the wife he had left 20 years ago finally decided to divorce him. Priest put the suit on over his work shirt and tied the 25-year-old pink and green kipper tie. The shoes had long worn out, so he put his sandals back on. Then he and Starr got in the Cuda. When they reached the county road, Priest said, "How come neither of us noticed she wasn't at home last night?" "I went to say good night to her, but Pearl told me she had gone to the privy." "I got that story, too. Pearl must have known what happened and covered up for her." Pearl, the daughter of Dale and Poem, was 12 years old and Flower's best friend. "I went back later, but all the candles were out and the bunkhouse was in darkness, so I didn't want to wake them up. I never imagined..." "Why would you? The darn kid has spent every night of her life in the same place. No reason to think she was anywhere else." They drove into Silver City. The sheriff's office was next door to the courthouse. They entered a gloomy lobby decorated with yellowing news clippings of ancient murders. There was a reception desk behind a window with an intercom and a buzzer. A deputy in a khaki shirt and green tie said, "Help you?" Starr said, "My name is Stella Higgins, and you have my daughter here." The deputy gave them a hard look. Priest figured he was appraising them, wondering what kind of parents they were. He said, "Just one moment, please," and disappeared. Priest spoke to Starr in a low voice. "I think we should be respectable, law-abiding citizens who are appalled that a child of theirs is in trouble with the police. We have nothing but profound respect for law enforcement personnel. We are sorry to have caused trouble to such hard-working folk." "Gotcha," Starr said tightly. The door opened, and the deputy let them in. "Mr. and Mrs. Higgins," he said. Priest did not correct him. "Follow me, please." He led them to a conference room with a gray carpet and bland, modern furniture. Flower was waiting. She was going to be formidable and voluptuous like her mother one day, but at 13 she was still a lanky, awkward girl. Now she was sullen and tearful at the same time, but she seemed unharmed. Starr hugged her silently, then Priest did the same. Starr said, "Honey, have you spent the night in jail?" Flower shook her head. "At some house," she said. The deputy explained. "California law is very strict. Juveniles can't be jailed under the same roof as adult criminals, so we have a couple of people in town who are willing to take charge of young offenders overnight." Flower stayed at the home of Miss Waterlow, a local schoolteacher who also happens to be the sheriff's sister. Priest asked Flower, "Was it okay?" The child nodded dumbly. He began to feel better. Hell, worse things can happen to kids. The deputy said, "Sit down, please, Mr. and Mrs. Higgins. I'm the probation officer, and it's part of my job to deal with juvenile offenders." They sat down. "Flower is charged with stealing a poster worth $9.99 from the Silver Disc Music Store." Starr turned to her daughter. "I can't understand this," she said. "Why would you steal a poster of a damn movie star?" Flower was suddenly vocal. She yelled, "I just wanted it, okay? I just wanted it!" Then she burst into tears. Priest addressed the deputy. "We'd like to take our daughter home as soon as possible. What do we need to do?" "Mr. Higgins, I should point out to you that the maximum penalty for what Flower has done would be imprisonment until the age of 21. "Jesus Christ!" Priest exclaimed. "However, I wouldn't expect such a harsh punishment for a first offense. Tell me, has Flower been in trouble before?" "Never." "Are you surprised by what she has done?"
"Yes."
"We're flabbergasted," said Starr. The deputy probed their home life, trying to establish whether Flower was well cared for. Priest answered most of the questions, giving the impression that they were simple agricultural workers. He said nothing of their communal life or their beliefs. The deputy asked where Flower attended school, and Priest explained that there was a school at the winery for the children of workers. The deputy seemed satisfied with the answers. Flower had to sign a promise to appear in court in 4 weeks' time at 10 a.m. The deputy asked for one of the parents to countersign, and Starr obliged. They did not have to post bail. They were out of there in less than an hour. Outside the sheriff's office, Priest said, "This doesn't make you a bad person, Flower. You did a dumb thing, but we love you as much as we always did. Just remember that, and we'll all talk about it when we get home." They drove back to the winery. For a while, Priest had been unable to think about anything except how his daughter was, but now that he had her back safe and well, he began to reflect on the wider implications of her arrest. The commune had never previously attracted the attention of the police. There was no theft because they did not acknowledge private property. Sometimes there were fistfights, but the communards dealt with such situations themselves. No one had ever died here. They had no phone to call the police. They never broke any laws except the drug laws, and they were discreet about that. But now the place was on the map. It was the worst possible moment for this to happen. There was nothing he could do about it other than to be extra cautious. He resolved not to blame Flower. At her age, he had been a full-time professional thief with an arrest record that stretched back 3 years. If any parent could understand, he should. He switched on the car radio. At the top of the hour, there was a news bulletin. The last item referred to the earthquake threat. "Governor Mike Robeson meets with FBI agents this morning to discuss the terrorist group the Hammer of Eden, who have threatened to cause an earthquake," said the newsreader. The spokesman for the Bureau said that all threats are taken seriously, but would not comment further ahead of the meeting. The governor would make his announcement after he met with the FBI, Priest guessed. He wished the radio station had given the time of the meeting. It was mid-morning when they got home. Melanie's car was gone from the parking circle. She had taken Dusty to San Francisco to leave him with his father for the weekend. There was a subdued air at the winery. Most of the group were weeding in the vineyard, working without the usual songs and laughter. Outside the cookhouse, Holly, the mother of his sons Ringo and Smiler, grimly fried onions, while Slow, who was always sensitive to atmosphere, looked frightened as he scrubbed early potatoes from the vegetable garden. Even Oak Tree, the carpenter, seemed quiet as he bent over his workbench, sawing a plank. When they saw Priest and Star returning with Flower, they all began to finish up the tasks they were doing and head for the temple. When there was a crisis, they always met to discuss it. If it was a minor matter, it could wait until the end of the day, but this was too important to be postponed. On their way to the temple, Priest and his family were intercepted by Dale and Poem with their daughter, Pearl. Dale, a small man with neat short hair, was the most conventional one in the group. He was a key person because he was an expert winemaker and he controlled the blend of each year's vintage. But Priest sometimes felt he treated the commune as if it were any other village. Dale and Poem had been the first couple to build a family cabin. Poem was a dark-skinned woman with a French accent. She had a wild streak. Priest knew he had slept with her many times, but with Dale she had become kind of domesticated. Dale was one of the few who might conceivably make the readjustment to normal life if he had to leave. Most of them would not, Priest felt. They would end up in jail or institutionalized or dead. "There's something you should see," Dale said. Priest noticed a quick interchange between the girls. Flower shot an accusing glare at Pearl, who looked frightened and guilty. "What now?" said Star. Dale led them all to the one empty cabin. At present it was used as a study room by the older children. There was a rough table, some chairs, and a cupboard containing books and pencils. The ceiling had a trap door leading to a crawl space under the sloping roof. Now the trap door was open, and a step ladder stood beneath it. Priest had a horrible feeling he knew what was coming. Dale lit a candle and went up the ladder. Priest and Star followed. In the roof space, illuminated by the flickering candle, they saw the girls' secret cache. A box full of cheap jewelry, makeup, fashionable clothes, and teen magazines. Priest said quietly, "All the things we brought them up to consider worthless." Dale said, "They've been hitchhiking to Silver City. They've done it 3 times in the past 4 weeks. They take these clothes and change out of their jeans and work shirts when they get there." Star said, "What do they do there?" "Hang out on the street, talk to boys, and steal from stores." Priest put his hand into the box and pulled out a narrow-bodied T-shirt, blue, with a single orange stripe. It was made of nylon and felt thin and trashy. It was the kind of clothing he despised. It gave no warmth or protection, and it did nothing but cover the beauty of the human body with a layer of ugliness. With the shirt in his hand, he retreated down the stepladder. Star and Dale followed. The two girls looked mortified. Priest said, "Let's go to the temple and discuss this with the group." By the time they got there, everyone else had assembled, children included. They were sitting cross-legged on the floor, waiting. Priest sat in the middle, as always. The discussions were democratic in theory, and the commune had no leaders, but in practice he and Star dominated all meetings. Priest would steer the dialogue toward the outcome he wanted, usually by asking questions rather than stating a point of view. If he liked an idea, he would encourage a discussion of its benefits. If he wanted to squash a proposal, he would ask how they could be sure it would work. And if the mood of the meeting was against him, he would pretend to be persuaded, then subvert the decision later. "Who wants to begin?" he said. Aneth spoke up. She was a motherly type in her 40s, and she believed in understanding rather than condemning. She said, "Maybe Flower and Pearl should begin by telling us why they wanted to go to Silver City."
"To meet people," Flower said defiantly.
Aneth smiled.
"Boys, you mean?"
Flower shrugged.
Aneth said, "Well, I guess that's understandable, but why did you have to steal?"
"To look nice."
Star gave an exasperated sigh.
"What's wrong with your regular clothes?"
"Mom, be serious," Flower said scornfully.
Star leaned forward and slapped her face. Flower gasped. A red mark appeared on her cheek.
"Don't you dare speak to me that way," Star said.
"You've just been caught stealing, and I've had to get you out of jail, so don't talk as if I'm the stupid one."
Pearl started to cry. Priest sighed. He should have seen this coming. There was nothing wrong with the clothes in the free shop. They had jeans in blue, black, or tan, denim work shirts, T-shirts in white, gray, red, and yellow, sandals and boots, heavy wool sweaters for the winter, waterproof coats for working in the rain. But the same clothes were worn by everyone and had been for years. Of course the children wanted something different. 35 years ago, Priest had stolen a beetle jacket from a boutique called Rave on San Pedro Street. Poem said to her daughter,
"Pearl, Cherie, you don't like your clothes?"
Between sobs, she said,
"We wanted to look like Melanie."
"Ah," Priest said, and he saw it all. Melanie was still wearing the clothes she had brought here. Skimpy tops that showed her midriff, miniskirts and short shorts, funky shoes and cute caps. She looked chic and sexy. It was not surprising the girls had adopted her as a role model. Dale said, "We need to talk about Melanie." He sounded apprehensive. Most of them were nervous about saying anything that might be seen as a criticism of Priest. Priest felt defensive. He had brought Melanie here, and he was her lover. And she was crucial to the plan. She was the only one who could interpret the data from Michael's disk, which had now been copied onto her laptop. Priest could not let them turn on her. "We never make people change their clothes when they join us," he said. "They wear out their old stuff first. It's always been the rule." Alaska spoke up. A former schoolteacher, she had come here with her lover, Juice, 10 years ago, after they had been ostracized in the small town where they lived for coming out as lesbians.
"It's not just her clothes," Alaska said. "She doesn't do much work."
Juice nodded agreement. Priest argued, "I've seen her in the kitchen, washing dishes and baking cookies." Alaska looked scared, but she persisted.
"Some light domestic chores. She doesn't work in the vineyard. She's a passenger, Priest."
Star saw Priest coming under attack and weighed in on his side.
"We've had a lot of people like that. Remember what Holly was like when she first came?"
Holly had been a bit like Melanie, a pretty girl who was attracted first to Priest and then to the commune. Holly grinned ruefully.
"I admit it, I was lazy, but eventually I started to feel bad about not pulling my weight. Nobody said anything to me. I just realized I'd be happier doing my fair share." Now Garden spoke. A former junkie, she was 25 but looked 40.
"Melanie's a bad influence. She talks to the kids about pop records and TV shows and trash like that."
Priest said, "Obviously, we need to have a discussion with Melanie about this when she gets back from San Francisco. I know she's going to be very upset when she hears what Flower and Pearl have done." Dale was not satisfied.
"What bugs a lot of us..."
Priest frowned. This sounded as if a group of them had been talking behind his back. "Jesus, have I got a full-scale rebellion on my hands?" He let his displeasure show in his voice. "Well, what bugs a lot of you?"
Dale swallowed. "Her mobile phone and computer."
There was no power line into the valley, so they had few electrical appliances. And there had grown up a kind of puritanism about things like TV and videotapes. Priest had to listen to his car radio to hear the news. They had come to look down on anything electrical. Melanie's equipment, which she recharged at the public library in Silver City by plugging into an outlet normally used for the vacuum cleaner, had drawn some disapproving stares. Now several people nodded agreement with Dale's complaint. There was a special reason why Melanie had to keep her mobile and her computer, but Priest could not explain it to Dale. He was not a rice-eater. Although he was a full member of the group and had been here for years, Priest could not be sure he would go along with the earthquake plan. He might freak. Priest realized he had to end this. It was getting out of control. Discontented people had to be dealt with one by one, not in a collective discussion where they reinforced one another. But before he could say anything, Poem weighed in.
"Priest, is there something going on? Something you're not telling us about? I never really understood why you and Star had to go away for 2.5 weeks.
Song, supporting Priest, said,
"Wow, that's such a mistrustful question."
The group was falling apart, Priest could see. It was the imminent prospect of having to leave the valley. There was no sign of the miracle he had hinted at. They saw their world coming to an end.
Star said, "I thought I told everyone. I had an uncle who died and left his affairs in a tangle, and I was his only relative, so I had to help the lawyers straighten everything out."
"Enough." Priest knew how to choke off a protest. He spoke decisively. "I feel we're discussing these things in a bad atmosphere," he said. "Does anyone agree with me?" They all did, of course. Most of them nodded. "What do we do about it?" Priest looked at his 10-year-old son, a dark-eyed, serious child. "What do you say, Ringo?"
"We meditate together," the boy said.
It was the answer any of them would give. Priest looked around. "Does everyone approve of Ringo's idea?" They did. "Then let's make ourselves ready." Each of them assumed the position they liked. Some lay flat on their backs, others bent into a fetal curl, one or two lay as if sleeping. Priest and several others sat cross-legged, hands loose on their knees, eyes closed, faces raised to heaven.
"Relax the small toe of your left foot," Priest said in a quiet, penetrating voice. "Then the fourth toe, then the third, then the second, then the big toe. Relax your whole foot, and your ankle, and then your calf."
As he went slowly around the body, a contemplative peace descended on the room. People's breathing slowed and became even, their bodies grew more and more still, and their faces gradually took on the tranquility of meditation. Finally, Priest said a slow, deep syllable, "Om." With one voice, the congregation replied, "Om." "My people, may they live here forever." Chapter 6. The meeting at the governor's office was scheduled for 12 noon. Sacramento, the state capital, was a couple of hours' drive from San Francisco. Judy left home at 9:45 to allow for heavy traffic getting out of the city. The aide she was to meet, Al Honeymoon, was a well-known figure in California politics. Officially cabinet secretary, he was in fact hatchet man. Any time Governor Robeson needed to run a new highway through a beauty spot, build a nuclear power station, fire 1,000 government employees, or betray a faithful friend, he got Honeymoon to do the dirty work. The two men had been colleagues for 20 years.
When they met, Mike Robeson was still only a state assemblyman, and Honeymoon was fresh out of law school. Honeymoon had been selected for his bad guy role because he was black, and the governor had shrewdly calculated that the press would hesitate to vilify a black man. Those liberal days were long gone, but Honeymoon had matured into a political operator of great skill and utter ruthlessness. No one liked him, but plenty of people were scared of him. For the sake of the Bureau, Judy wanted to make a good impression on him. It was not often that political types had a direct personal interest in an FBI case. Judy knew that her handling of this assignment would forever color Honeymoon's attitude to the Bureau and to law enforcement agencies in general. Personal experience always had more impact than reports and statistics. The FBI liked to appear all-powerful and infallible, but she had made so little progress with the case that it would be kind of difficult to play that part, especially to a hard-ass like Honeymoon. Anyway, it was not her style. Her plan was simply to appear efficient and inspire confidence. And she had another reason for giving a good account of herself. She wanted Governor Robeson's statement to open the door to a dialogue with the Hammer of Eden. A hint that the governor might negotiate could just persuade them to hold off. And if they responded by trying to communicate, that might give Judy new clues to who they were. Right now, it was the only way she could think of to catch them. All other lines of inquiry had led to dead ends. She thought it might be difficult to persuade the governor to give this hint. He would not want to give the impression he would listen to terrorist demands for fear of encouraging others. But there should be a way to word the statement so that the message was clear only to the Hammer of Eden people. She was not wearing her Armani power suit. Instinct told her that Honeymoon was more likely to warm to someone who came on as a working Joe, so she had put on a steel-gray pantsuit, tied her hair back in a neat knot, and carried her gun in a holster on her hip. In case that was too severe, she wore small pearl earrings that called attention to her long neck. It never did any harm to look attractive. She wondered idly whether Michael Quirkus found her attractive. He was a dish. Shame he was so irritating. Her mother would have approved of him. Judy could remember her saying, "I like a man who takes charge." Quirkus dressed nicely in an understated kind of way. She wondered what his body was like under his clothes. Maybe he was covered with dark hair like a monkey. She did not like hairy men. Maybe he was pale and soft, but she thought not. He seemed fit. She realized she was fantasizing about Quirkus in the nude, and she felt annoyed with herself. The last thing I need is a bad-tempered matinee idol. She decided to call ahead and check the parking. She dialed the governor's office on her cell phone and got Honeymoon's secretary. "I have a 12 noon meeting with Mr. Honeymoon, and I'm wondering if I can park at the Capitol building. I've never been to Sacramento before." The secretary was a young man. "We have no visitor parking at the building, but there's a parking garage on the next block." "Where exactly is that?" "The entrance is on 10th Street between K Street and L. The Capitol building is on 10th between L and M. It's literally a minute away. But your meeting isn't at noon. It's at 11:30.
"What? Your meeting is scheduled for 11:30. Has it been changed?"
"No, ma'am. It always was 11:30. Judy was furious. To arrive late would create a bad impression even before she opened her mouth. This was already going wrong. She controlled her anger.
"I guess someone made a mistake."
She checked her watch. If she drove like hell, she could be there in 90 minutes.
"It's no problem. I'm running ahead of schedule," she lied. "I'll be there."
"Very good." She put her foot down and watched the Monte Carlo's speedometer climb to 100. Fortunately, the road was not busy. Most of the morning traffic was headed the other way into San Francisco. Brian Kincaid had told her the time of the meeting, so he would be late, too. They were traveling separately because he had a second appointment in Sacramento, at the FBI field office there. Judy dialed the San Francisco office and spoke to the SAC secretary.
"Linda, this is Judy. Would you call Brian and tell him the governor's aide is expecting us at 11:30, not 12 noon, please?"
"I think he knows that," Linda said.
"No, he doesn't. He told me 12. See if you can reach him and warn him."
"Sure will.
Thanks."
Judy hung up and concentrated on her driving. A few minutes later, she heard a police siren. She looked in her mirror and saw the familiar tan paint job of a California Highway Patrol car.
I do not fucking believe this, she said. She pulled over and braked hard. The patrol car pulled in behind her. She opened her door. An amplified voice said, Stay in the car! She took out her FBI shield, held it at arm's length so the cop could see it, then got out. Stay in the car! She heard a note of fear in the voice and saw that the patrolman was alone. She sighed. She could just imagine some rookie cop pulling a gun and shooting her out of nervousness. She held out her shield so he could see it. FBI! She shouted. Look, for Christ's sake! Get back in the car! She looked at her watch. It was 10:30. Shaking with frustration, she sat in her car. She left the door open. There was a maddeningly long wait. At last, the patrolman approached her. The reason I stopped you is that you were doing 99 miles per hour. Just look at this, she said, holding out her shield. What's that? For Christ's sake, it's an FBI shield. I'm an agent on urgent business, and you've just delayed me. Well, you sure don't look like... She jumped out of the car, startling him, and waved a finger under his chin. Don't you tell me I don't look like a fucking agent. You don't recognize an FBI shield, so how would you know what an agent looks like? She put her hands on her hips, pushing her jacket back so that he could see her holster. Can I see your license, please? Hell no. I'm leaving now, and I'm going to drive to Sacramento at 99 miles per hour. Do you understand? She got back into the car. You can't do that, he said. Write your congressman, she said, and she slammed the door and drove off. She moved into the fast lane, accelerated to 100, then checked her watch. She had wasted about 5 minutes. She could still make it. She had lost her temper with the patrolman. He would tell his superior, who would complain to the FBI. Judy would get a reprimand, but if she had been polite to the guy, she would still be there. Shit, she said feelingly. She reached the turnoff for downtown Sacramento at 11:20. By 11:25, she was entering the parking garage on 10th Street. It took her a couple of minutes to find a slot. She ran down the staircase and across the street. The Capitol building was a white stone palace like a wedding cake, set in immaculate gardens bordered by giant palm trees. She hurried along a marble hall to a large doorway with Governor carved over it. She stopped, took a couple of calming breaths, and checked her watch. It was exactly 11:30. She had got there on time. The bureau would not look incompetent. She opened the double doors and stepped inside. She found herself in a large lobby presided over by a secretary behind an enormous desk. On one side was a row of chairs where, to her surprise, she saw Brian Kincaid waiting, looking cool and relaxed in a crisp dark gray suit, his white hair combed neatly, not at all like someone who had rushed to get here. She was suddenly conscious that she was perspiring. When Kincaid caught her eye, she saw a flash of surprise in his expression, swiftly suppressed. She said, hi, Brian. Morning. He looked away. He did not thank her for sending a message to warn him that the meeting was earlier. She asked, what time did you get here? A few minutes ago. That meant he had known the correct time for the meeting. But he had told her it was half an hour later. Surely he had not deliberately misled her. It seemed almost childish. Before she had time to reach a conclusion, a young black man emerged from a side door. He spoke to Brian. Agent Kincaid? He stood up. That's me. And you must be Agent Maddox. Mr. Honeymoon will see you both now. They followed him along the corridor and around a corner. As they walked, he said, We call this the horseshoe because the governor's offices are grouped around three sides of a rectangle. Halfway along the second side, they passed another lobby, this one occupied by two secretaries. A young man holding a file waited on a leather couch. Judy guessed that was the way to the governor's personal office. A few steps on, they were shown into Honeymoon's room. He was a big man with close-cropped hair turning gray. He had taken off the coat of his gray pinstripe suit to reveal black suspenders. The sleeves of his white shirt were rolled, but his silk tie was fastened tight in a high pin-through collar. He removed a pair of gold-rimmed half-glasses and stood up. He had a dark, sculptured face that wore a don't-fuck-with-me expression.
He could have been a police lieutenant, except he was too well-dressed. Despite his intimidating appearance, his manner was courteous. He shook their hands and said, "I appreciate your coming here all the way from San Francisco." "No problem," said Kincaid. They sat down. Without preamble, Honeymoon said, "What's your assessment of the situation?" Kincaid said, "Well, sir, you particularly asked to meet with the agent at the sharp end, so I'll let Judy here fill you in." Judy said, "We haven't caught these people yet, I'm afraid." Then she cursed herself for beginning with an apology. "Be positive." "We're fairly sure they're not connected with the Green California campaign. That was a weak attempt to lay a false trail. We don't know who they are, but I can tell you some important things we have found out about them." Honeymoon said, "Go ahead, please." "First of all, linguistic analysis of the threat message tells us we're dealing not with a lone individual, but with a group." Kincaid said, "Well, two people at least." Judy glared at Kincaid, but he did not meet her eye. Honeymoon said irritably, "Which is it, two or a group?" Judy felt herself blush. "The message was composed by a man and typed by a woman, so there are at least two. We don't know yet if there are more." "Okay, but please be exact." This was not going well. Judy pressed on. "Point two, these people are not insane." Kincaid said, "Well, not clinically, but they sure as hell aren't normal." He laughed as if he had said something witty. Judy silently cursed him for undermining her. "People who commit crimes of violence can be divided into two kinds, organized and disorganized. The disorganized kind act on the spur of the moment, use whatever weapons come to hand, and choose their victims at random. They're the real crazies." Honeymoon was interested. "And the other kind?" "The organized ones plan their crimes, carry their weapons with them, and attack victims who have been selected beforehand using some logical criteria." Kincaid said, "They're just crazy in a different way." Judy tried to ignore him. "Such people may be sick, but they are not Looney Tunes. We can think of them as rational and try to anticipate what they might do."
"All right, and the Hammer of Eden people are organized?"
"Judging by their threat message, yes."
"You rely a great deal on this linguistic analysis," Honeymoon said skeptically.
"It's a powerful tool."
Kincaid put in, "It's no substitute for careful investigative work, but in this case it's all we've got."
The implication seemed to be that they had to fall back on linguistic analysis because Judy had failed to do the legwork. Feeling desperate, she struggled on. "We're dealing with serious people, which means that if they can't cause an earthquake, they may attempt something else."
"Such as?"
"One of the more usual terrorist acts. Explode a bomb, take a hostage, murder a prominent figure."
Kincaid said, "Assuming they have the capability, of course. So far we've nothing to indicate that."
Judy took a deep breath. There was something she had to say, and she could not avoid it. "However, I'm not prepared to rule out the possibility that they really could cause an earthquake."
Honeymoon said, "What?"
Kincaid laughed scornfully. Judy said stubbornly, "It's not likely, but it's conceivable. That's what I was told by California's leading expert, Professor Quirkus. I'd be failing in my duty if I didn't tell you."
Kincaid leaned back in his chair and crossed his legs. "Judy has told you the textbook answers, Al," he said in a we're-all-boys-together tone of voice. "Now maybe I should tell you how it looks from the perspective of a certain amount of age and experience."
Judy stared at him. "I'll get you for this if it's the last thing I do, Kincaid. You spent this entire meeting putting me down. But what if there really is an earthquake, you asshole? What will you say to the relatives of the dead?"
"Please go on," Honeymoon said to Kincaid.
"These people can't cause an earthquake, and they don't give a flying fuck about power plants. My instinct tells me this is a guy trying to impress his girlfriend. He's got the governor freaked out, he's got the FBI running around like blue-assed flies, and the whole thing is on the John Truth radio show every night. Suddenly he's a big shot, and she's like, wow."
Judy felt totally humiliated. Kincaid had let her lay out her findings and then poured scorn on everything she had said. He had obviously planned this, and she was now sure that he had deliberately misled her about the time of the meeting in the hope that she would show up late. The whole thing was a strategy for discrediting her and at the same time making Kincaid look better. She felt sick. Honeymoon stood up suddenly.
"I'm going to advise the governor to take no action on this threat."
He added dismissively, "Thank you both."
Judy realized it was too late to ask him to open the door to dialogue with the terrorists. The moment had passed, and any suggestion of hers would be nixed by Kincaid anyway. She felt despairing. What if it's real? What if they actually can do it?
Kincaid said, "Any time we can be of assistance, you just let us know."
Honeymoon looked faintly scornful. He hardly needed an invitation to use the services of the FBI, but he politely held out his hand to shake. A moment later, Judy and Kincaid were outside. Judy remained silent as they walked around the horseshoe and through the lobby into the marble hallway. There, Kincaid stopped and said,
"You did just fine in there, Judy. Don't you worry about a thing."
He could not conceal his smirk. She was determined not to let him see how rattled she was. She wanted to scream at him, but she forced herself to say calmly, "I think we did our job."
"Sure we did. Where are you parked?"
"In the garage across the street."
She jerked a thumb. "I'm the opposite side. See you later."
"You bet."
Judy watched him walk away, then she turned and went in the other direction. Crossing the street, she saw a See's candy store. She went in and bought some chocolates. Driving back to San Francisco, she ate the whole box.
Chapter 7 Priest needed physical activity to keep him from going crazy with tension. After the meeting in the temple, he went to the vineyard and started weeding. It was a hot day, and he soon worked up a sweat and took off his shirt. Star worked beside him. After an hour or so, she looked at her watch.
"Time for a break," she said. "Let's go listen to the news."
They sat in Priest's car and turned on the radio. The bulletin was identical to the one they had heard earlier. Priest ground his teeth in frustration.
"Damn, the governor has to say something soon."
Star said, "We don't expect him to give in right away, do we?"
"No, but I thought there would be some message, maybe just a hint of a concession. Hell, the idea of a freeze on new power plants ain't exactly wacko. Millions of people in California probably agree with it."
Star nodded.
"Shit, in Los Angeles it's already dangerous to breathe because of the pollution, for Christ's sake. I can't believe people really want to live that way."
"But nothing happens."
"Well, we figured all along we'd need to give a demonstration before they'd listen."
"Yeah."
Priest hesitated, then blurted, "I guess I'm just scared it won't work."
"The seismic vibrator?" He hesitated again. He would not have been this frank with anyone but Star, and he was already half regretting his confession of doubt. But he had begun, so he might as well finish.
"The whole thing," he said. "I'm scared there'll be no earthquake, and then we'll be lost."
She was a little shocked, he could see. She was used to him being supremely confident about everything he did. But he had never done anything like this. Walking back to the vineyard, she said, "Do something with Flower tonight."
"What do you mean?"
"Spend time with her. Do something with her. You're always playing with Dusty." Dusty was 5. It was easy to have fun with him. He was fascinated by everything. Flower was 13, the age when everything grown-ups did seemed stupid. Priest was about to say this when he realized there was another reason for what Star was saying. "She thinks I may die tomorrow." The thought hit him like a punch. He knew that this earthquake plan was dangerous, of course, but he had mainly considered the peril to himself and the risk of leaving the commune leaderless. He had not imagined Flower alone in the world at the age of 13.
"What'll I do with her?" he said.
"She wants to learn the guitar." That was news to Priest. He was not much of a guitarist himself, but he could play folk songs and simple blues, enough to get her started anyway. He shrugged.
"Okay, we'll start tonight."
They went back to work, but a few minutes later they were interrupted when Slow, grinning from ear to ear, shouted, "Hey, look at who's here!" Priest looked across the vineyard. The person he was waiting for was Melanie. She had gone to San Francisco to take Dusty to his father. She was the only one who could tell Priest exactly where to use the seismic vibrator,
and he would not feel comfortable until she was back. But it was too early to expect her, and anyway, Slo would not have gotten so excited about Melanie. He saw a man coming down the hill, followed by a woman carrying a child. Priest frowned. Often a year went by without a single visitor coming to the valley. This morning they had had the cop, now these people. But were they strangers? He narrowed his eyes. The man's rolling walk was terribly familiar. As the figures got closer, Priest said, "My God, is that Bones?" "Yes, it is," Star said delightedly. "Holy moly!" And she hurried toward the newcomers. Spirit joined in the excitement and ran with her, barking. Priest followed more slowly. Bones, whose real name was Billy Owens, was a rice-eater. But he had liked the way things were before Priest arrived. He enjoyed the hand-to-mouth existence of the early commune. He reveled in the constant crises and liked to be drunk or stoned, or both, within a couple of hours of waking up. He played the blues harmonica with manic brilliance and was the most successful street beggar they had. He had not joined a commune to find work, self-discipline, and a daily act of worship. So, after a couple of years, when it became clear that the priest-star regime was permanent, Bones took off. He had not been seen since. Now, after more than 20 years, he was back. Star threw her arms around him, hugged him hard, and kissed his lips. Those two had been a serious item for a while. All the men in the commune had slept with Star in those days, but she had had a special soft spot for Bones. Priest felt a twinge of jealousy as he watched Bones press Star's body to his own. When they let each other go, Priest could see that Bones did not look well. He had always been a thin man, but now he looked as if he were dying of starvation. He had wild hair and a straggly beard, but the beard was matted and the hair seemed to be falling out in clumps. His jeans and T-shirt were dirty, and the heel had come off one of his cowboy boots. "He's here because he's in trouble." Bones introduced the woman as Debbie. She was younger than he, no more than 25, and pretty in a pinched-looking way. Her child was a boy about 18 months old. She and the kid were almost as thin and dirty as Bones. It was time for their midday meal. They took Bones to the cookhouse. Lunch was a casserole made with pearl barley and flavored with herbs grown by garden. Debbie ate ravenously and fed the child, too, but Bones took just a couple of spoonfuls, then lit a cigarette. There was a lot of talk about the old times. Bones said, "I'll tell you my favorite memory. One afternoon right on that hillside over there, Star explained to me about cunnilingus." There was a ripple of laughter around the table. It was faintly embarrassed laughter, but Bones failed to pick up on that, and he went on. "I was 20 years old, and I never knew people did that. I was shocked. But she made me try it, and the taste? Yuck!" "There was a lot you didn't know," Star said. "I remember you telling me that you couldn't understand why you sometimes got headaches in the morning, and I had to explain to you that it happened whenever you got falling down drunk the night before. You didn't know the meaning of the word hangover." She had deftly changed the subject. In the old days, it had been perfectly normal to talk about cunnilingus around the table, but things had changed since Bones left. No one had ever made an issue of cleaning up their conversation, but it had happened naturally as the children started to understand more. Bones was nervy, laughing a lot, trying too hard to be friendly, fidgeting, chain-smoking. "He wants something, but he'll tell me what it is soon enough." As they cleared the table and washed the bowls, Bones took Priest aside and said, "Got something I want to show you. Come on." Priest shrugged and went with him. As they walked, Priest took out a little bag of marijuana and a pack of cigarette papers. The communards did not usually smoke dope during the day because it slowed down the work in the vineyard, but today was a special day, and Priest felt the need to soothe his nerves. As they walked up the hill and through the trees, he rolled a joint with the ease of long practice. Bones licked his lips. "You don't have anything with, like, more of a kick, do you?" "What are you using these days, Bones?" "A little brown sugar now and again, you know, keep my head straight." Heroin. So that was it. Bones had become a junkie. "We don't have any smack here," Priest told him. "No one uses it." "And I'd get rid of anyone who did faster than you can say spike." Priest lit the joint. When they reached the clearing where the cars were parked, Bones said, "This is it." At first, Priest could not work out what he was looking at. It was a truck, but what kind? It was painted with a gay design in bright red and yellow, and along the side was a picture of a monster breathing fire and some lettering in the same gaudy colors. Bones, who knew that Priest could not read, said, "The Dragon's Mouth. It's a carnival ride." Priest saw it then. A lot of small carnival rides were mounted on trucks. The truck engine powered the ride in use. Then the parts of the ride could be folded down and the truck driven to the next site. Priest passed in the joint and said, "Is it yours?" Bones took a long toke, held the smoke down, then blew out before answering. "I've been making my living from this for 10 years, but it needs work and I can't afford to get it fixed, so I have to sell it." Now Priest could see what was coming. Bones took another draw on the joint, but did not hand it back. "It's probably worth $50,000, but I'm asking 10. Priest nodded. "Sounds like a bargain for someone." "Maybe you guys should buy it," Bones said. "What the fuck would I do with a carnival ride, Bones?" "It's a good investment. If you have a bad year with the wine, you can go out with the ride and make some money." They had bad years sometimes. There was nothing they could do about the weather. But Paul Beale was always willing to give them credit. He believed in the ideals of the commune, even though he had been unable to live up to them himself. And he knew there would always be another vintage next year. Priest shook his head. "No way. But I wish you luck, old buddy. Keep trying. You'll find a buyer." Bones must have known it had been a long shot, but all the same he looked panicky. "Hey, Priest, you want to know the truth of it. I'm in bad shape. Could you loan me $1,000? That'd get me straight." "It would get you stoned out of your head, you mean. Then after a few days you'd be right back where you were." "We don't have any money," Priest told him. "We don't use it here, don't you remember that?" Bones looked crafty. "You gotta have a stash somewhere, come on." "And you think I'm going to tell you about it?" "Sorry, pal, can't help." Bones nodded. "That's a bummer, man. I mean, I'm in serious trouble." Priest said, "And don't try to go behind my back and ask Star, because you'll get the same answer." He put a harsh note into his voice. "Are you listening to me?"
"Sure, sure," Bones said, looking scared. "Be cool, Priest, man, be cool."
"I'm cool," Priest said. Priest worried about Melanie all afternoon. She might have changed her mind and decided to go back to her husband or simply got scared and taken off in her car. Then he would be finished. There was no way he or anyone else could interpret the data on Michael Quirkus's disk and figure out where to place the seismic vibrator tomorrow. But she showed up at the end of the afternoon, to his great relief. He told her about Flower being arrested and warned her that one or two people wanted to put the blame on Melanie and her cute clothes. She said she would get some work clothes from the free shop. After supper, Priest went to Song's cabin and picked up her guitar. "Are you using this?" he said politely. He would never say, "May I borrow your guitar?" because in theory all property was communal, so the guitar was his as much as hers, even though she had made it. However, in practice, everyone always asked. He sat outside his cabin with Flower and tuned the guitar. Spirit, the dog, watched alertly, as if he, too, were going to learn to play. "Most songs have three chords," Priest began. "If you know three chords, you can play 9 out of 10 of the songs in the whole world." He showed her the chord of C. As she struggled to press the strings with her soft fingertips, he studied her face in the evening light. Her perfect skin, the dark hair, green eyes like stars, the little frown as she concentrated. "I have to stay alive, to take care of you." He thought of himself at that age, already a criminal, experienced, skilled, hardened to violence, with a hatred of cops and a contempt for ordinary citizens who were dumb enough to let themselves get robbed. At 13, I had already gone wrong. He was determined that Flower would not be like that. She had been brought up in a community of love and peace, untouched by the world that had corrupted little Ricky Granger and turned him into a hoodlum before he grew hair on his chin. "You'll be okay. I'll make sure of it." She played the chord, and Priest realized that a particular song had been running in his head ever since Bones arrived. It was a folky number from the early 60s that Star had always liked. Show me the prison, show me the jail, show me the prisoner whose life has gone stale. I'll teach you a song your mama used to sing to you when you were a baby, he said. He took the guitar from her. Do you remember this? He sang, I'll show you a young man with so many reasons why. In his head he heard Star's unmistakable voice, low and sexy then as now. There but for fortune, go you or I, you or I. Priest was about the same age as Bones, and Bones was dying. Priest had no doubt about that. Soon the girl and the baby would leave him. He would starve his body and feed his habit. He might overdose or poison himself with bad drugs, or he might just abuse his system until it gave up and he got pneumonia. One way or another, he was a dead man. If I lose this place, I'll go the same way as Bones. As Flowers struggled to play the chord of A minor, Priest toyed with the idea of returning to normal society. He fantasized going every day to a job, buying socks and wingtip shoes, owning a TV set and a toaster. The thought made him queasy. He had never lived straight. He had been brought up in a whorehouse, educated